Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we're up to minute 64, one of my favorite binary numbers. And we're going to call this episode Packing Up, I think, is the best way to describe this, because there's a lot going on moving day at the old Hydra compound. So, Hal, why don't you fill us in the details of what's going on up there in the mountains?
All right. I'm picturing the U-Haul trucks pulling in.
they hired the extra guys from College Hunks and all that, yeah.
Right. So. All right, minute 64. In the Hydra factory's control room, Johann Schmidt methodically flips switches on the control panel, activating the self-destruct systems. Alarms blare as timers begin their countdown. A terrified Hydra technician bolts from the control room, sprinting onto a bridge overlooking the factory floor. He runs headlong into Steve Rogers, who slams his shield into the technician's chest. The man tumbles over the railing, plummeting to the floor below. Steve hurries across the bridge, his focus unwavering. Outside, the 107th prisoners wreak havoc in the factory yard, dodging machine gun fire and explosions. Falsworth, leading the charge, shouts, "Keep moving! Grab those grenades!" The troopers snatch grenades from a crate, lobbing them at Hydra soldiers, blast tearing through the compound. Back in the control room, Schmidt presses a button and the Tesseract cube, glowing an unearthly blue, rises from its cylindrical chamber. A timer on the panel ticks down, 2 minutes, 42 seconds. Across the room, Dr. Arnim Zola frantically stuffs papers and passports into a valise, tucking it under his arm. He snatches his hat and glances at a map on the wall, pinpointing other Hydra facilities before darting out. In a hallway, Zola spots Steve at the far end. They lock eyes briefly before Zola bolts in the opposite direction. Steve gives chase but slows, his attention caught by a dimly lit room off the corridor.
I was wondering, in real life, how many places... I'm trying to figure out if there's any place I've ever been to that has a self-destruct mechanism in it. It's like I don't know how often that comes up in the architectural plans. By the way, we need something if we ever have a problem to just destroy everything.
Well, there are. Yeah, I mean, a lot of places have self-destruct mechanisms built into them. You know, a nuclear power plant. All you need to do is turn off the water, more or less. Yeah. But you know, you remind me of a question that was frequently asked of, I think, astronauts in the early days of, you know, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, which is, did you carry suicide pills on your flights? And one of the astronauts, I forget which one, basically said, no, we don't need to do that. If we want to do that, we'll just you know, turn a knob and all the air will go out of the capsule and we'll peacefully die in our sleep, you know? I mean, it's really easy to commit suicide in space.
Yeah, but not dying is the hard part. So
right. Not dying is the hard part. So no self-destruct needed, you know. The tricky part is keeping you alive, not trying to keep you dead, make you dead.
Although certainly it's funny when you mentioned self-destruct, the first thing I thought of was at least unmanned rockets, you know, can be remotely detonated if need be. And that's probably... I would guess, Jim, in your life, that maybe one of the whatever launch you've been to may have been one of your closest times to something with self-destruct system.
Flight termination system, I think, is the nice euphemism for
it. Yes, it is a lovely euphemism.
Yeah, the only other thing I can think of is when I used to live in Virginia, I was near a company that made the ink packs that are in the bottom drawer of bank teller drawers, that when you're getting robbed, you put it. It's a flat packet that looks like the thing that you carry a travel pack of wet wipes in. It's this little flat pack, and it has like a printed dollar bill on the front, and it looks like more money, but it's one of those things when you pull it, I think it's something like it has a fuse on the thing, and you pull it, and then 10 minutes after you pull the tab, the ink explodes in whatever, you know, bag you have it in, destroying or making all the dollar bills and things turn bright pink. So I guess that's a type of destruct mechanism.
I had a friend who's since passed on, not because of the self-destruct thing I'm going to mention. he had this beautiful built-in safe in his basement, and it wasn't walk-in, but it was almost that big. Wow. And he was I would consider him actually in the world of this kind of collector, actually a very modest gun collector. But this safe was, you know, the door is 6 inches thick and it's all painted black. It's this iron thing. And then it just had a nice decorative thing on the side with, you know, his name, the so-and-so arms company and stuff. So it was, this wasn't a rabid gun nut, just guy. This is, he had a few and he liked to keep them in this safe, but he always told us that the door and the wall of the safe that faced into the room, that they were filled with gunpowder in case somebody were to ever break in and then try to cut their way into the safe with a torch.
Wow.
So I would have considered that not only sort of self-destruct, that's kind of a mutual assured destruction of his house and the others on the block. I've often wondered how true that was, sort of how much was in there, but never once did I consider going after it with a torch to try it.
The thing about mutually assured destruction, though, is the bad guys have to know that
they have
that
to know
exists.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. So,
interesting.
Anyway.
But my favorite example of self-destruct sequences is, of course, from Star Trek, particularly the search for Spock. And in which Kirk decides to blow up the Enterprise or has no choice because the Klingons are going to take it over. The beauty of that was that the self-destruct sequence used in that movie was exactly the same one as was used but aborted in the TV show. So I just, as a Trekkie watching Star Trek III, I got a big kick out of the fact that they were using the same commands to order the ship to destroy itself. But again, you know, it's a starship with an antimatter engine. It seems all you need to do is crack the door on the antimatter. Just an inch.
Lift the lid, yeah.
You're pretty much taking out, you know, half a planet.
There was, I am not kidding. I learned about a Supreme Court case from a Superman comic, and I can't remember the circumstances of the Superman comic, but I've just looked up. The case was called Cato versus Briney, and it was 1971 that this was issued. The Supreme Court said that had decided that you aren't allowed to booby trap your house.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I've read about that.
It's become a staple of court law. And, what happened was this, they basically set off they had a gun. I think it was something like a shotgun attached to a spring. And if anybody opened the roof from the outside, the shotgun would go off and it killed the guy that was trying to break in. And what the Supreme Court decided was you don't have the option to use deadly force on if you're in an unoccupied building. If you were at home and you had a shotgun and some guy came through your roof, yes, you would have, you know, the castle doctrine would apply. But having a robotic house that could use deadly force. Now you can use I've forgotten the name of you can use a sally port where you can lock people in. You can detain people if they've tried to break into your house. But just like you don't get the chance to kill them though. So it's
until you get home.
Yeah, until you get home and get the shotgun. Yes.
Yeah. Honey, who's that in the sally port?
It's just not your day. Yeah.
So I guess this exception would be called the Kevin McAllister clause from the Home Alone movies. You know, if you're a kid home alone, you can do whatever you want.
You get that can of paint and you just tie it right up at the top of the banister.
Tying back to Brian's favorite self-destruct thing, I think my favorite Star Trek related or adjacent self-destruct thing was in the Futurama episode where No Fan Has Gone Before, with they reunite the original series cast, and they're trying to get away on the ship, and they're looking at their options, and George Takei, who of course is just a head in a jar at this point, you know, says, you know, doesn't this ship have a self-destruct sequence like 1A, 2B, and then right then Bender explodes. and then he just goes, you know, thanks a lot, Takei. Now everybody knows. Awesome. That is one of the, I think that's some of the best 22 minutes of television ever made.
I do like I do like the one in Galaxy Quest where they solve all the issues of turning off the self-destruct mechanism, but the timer keeps winding down, but it stopped at one because it always stops at one.
Unless it's a Bond film, and then it
Yeah, then
starts
it's
at 007.
yes, when you're handcuffed to an atom bomb in Fort Knox, that's
That's how she
I
goes.
mean, and let's face it, who among us has never been in that situation?
Yes, you know, well, I mean, who did not expect to be in that situation?
Touche.
The only thing worse would be tied into, you know, if you were sinking in quicksand while you're trying to disarm it, red wire, blue wire, and
There's a neat moment in this minute of the film, I think about 10 seconds in, when Steve kicks or shoves one of the Hydra agents over the rail, and it was just such a beautiful wasted opportunity for a Wilhelm scream. I was really listening for it, but there was no Wilhelm scream there, and I wish there had been. Just oh, that, you know, classic scream
Yeah.
That would have been
used throughout
perfect.
decades and decades of movies. All the Star Wars films have a Wilhelm scream in them when somebody falls down a chasm or something. And boy, I bet they thought about it. I bet they thought about it and said, "No, we're not going to do that."
They wanted to, though,
Yeah,
so badly.
you don't want it to ever become distracting.
No, and it
you
would have
know
been.
just a nice little Easter egg.
Well, I would have laughed my head off in the theaters
Yeah.
if, But they are ramping up the violence again. In previous episodes, I've kind of talked about that, how it starts out with Steve invading the camp in almost a slapstick fashion, but now we're seeing people get blasted into blue mist, and
Right.
which is better than a bloody blue mist, I guess, a bloody red mist. But still, it's looks like a pretty horrific way to go.
Yeah, it's there's so much going on. I keep wondering about looking at this from an OSHA point of view. It doesn't seem to be. I mean, it's like I would think that you're trying to protect things in the carpool. I mean, I guess once you breach the outer wall, then apparently safety goes out the window. I mean, there's those potato masher grenades just kind of laying around in the motor pool. I don't understand that. Why? Well, I guess they were needed at the time. There is a great love of blueprints too. I noticed that. You know, again, Joe with his hiding blueprints everywhere, as Zola's tucking things in. There's so many blueprints, and we don't live in an age anymore of, at least I haven't seen them in a long time, of actual the carbonized blueprints. But they don't fold up that easily. If you ever use blueprints, they're kind of thick, and they, you know, if you try to do that, it's like, well, again, being old, it's like putting away a gas station map. I
What's
just,
that, Jim?
yeah, I know. It's back, you know, back there during the Civil War, we'd get off our horses and walk into this place that had a giant scallop on the front. And but it, you know, it's just, I was wondering what kind of Zola had probably invented some new paper that folded easily as he was stuffing it into that leather valise.
But then clearly kept it to himself. Yeah, we've got at EAA where I work, we've got archives of aircraft plans. So we have we don't have a ton of like truly traditional blueprints, but we do certainly have some. A lot of them though are just drawn on, you know, they're drawn on white paper and things. But it's funny you mentioned that difficulty of folding them up because for whatever reason in flying, what every normal person calls a map, we call a chart.
Yes.
And so the VFR sectional charts, which I still bring with me when I fly, even though I've got my GPS and iPad and all the other fancy stuff, I still have the paper backup. Nobody has ever like successfully refolded one of those, I think, in 80 years. So
Yeah, that's
one.
why you got to carry the little Jepson, the fold out one with the little three-ring binder that
Right. Yeah.
everybody,
And
that
those
no
are for
matter, you
the.
know, no matter what age you're in, no matter how advanced the technology comes, Jepson still sends out the pages that you have to put in between the other pages. So you're like,
Right.
where's 162 and
The
163 fitting in?
revisions. I remember as a kid so clearly, and these are basically I don't know if, like little 5x7s, a 3-ring binder, but it's not huge. So like 5x7-ish sheets. And it's all the instrument approaches. And yeah, you'd be adding some. This goes between this page and this page. But then that this page is out of date, tear that out, put this one in. And I remember my dad coming home from an airline trip, and it was every 56 days. that these revisions would come out, and he would be doing those. And I would always, I would take the old ones, because there was one particular paper airplane design that was absolutely perfect for those. The paper was just the right dimensions, the right size and weight, and that little design would fly flawlessly.
Wow. So, and you think and that paper itself had been flying for maybe 10 or 12,000 miles every
yeah,
year.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that it's like the paper was already experienced.
It was infused.
Know, been up there. Yeah.
It knew what it was like up in the blue. Yeah.
Infused in the spirit of the paper.
Right.
And that's how you could always identify the pilots. Well, besides the bars on their epaulets and things, but they'd always have that square Jepson bag that opens up on the top, and it never, it wasn't a valise like Zola's carrying, but it's a big square box with twisty things in it.
Very quickly before we get away from it, one of the handful of times my dad was ever sort of starstruck and really impressed by somebody he had on one of his flights. And he did have Sean Connery once, which he thought was pretty cool. But he had L. Ray Jepsen on. So,
oh wow!
L. Ray.
Do you know what I have to do every 56 days? Yeah,
he started this whole thing by he was an airmail pilot, and he just started a little notebook, and he would write notes. Hey, when you're coming into this airport, look out for this mountain. Go around here. Go over the city, and then descend here, and watch out for the trees. And that eventually became this massive data storehouse, which is still going strong to this day.
That's been. Did your dad have him sign his book?
I don't think he did, and I don't.
Oh, he should have.
I don't know why. That would have been just amazing.
And it would have been that one page that he. Oh no! Yeah. It was that revision three.
But that was also in the air when LRA was starting. When an instrument approach is a very, very precise procedure for getting you from inside the weather, out of the weather, down to an airport safely without being able to see outside. But in El Rey's era, there were some airports where the published approach procedure was to fly to this point above the clouds, then put the airplane into a spin, and then just spiral down kind of sort of out of control until you come out of the clouds at the bottom, and then you can recover and land. So...
Wow.
Different times, different days.
Yes. And the appropriate call sign is ta-da.
Oh, man. So, gents, this is a good minute for Toby Jones. I noticed as Toby Jones playing Arnim Zola is escaping from the facility. He's just a great physical actor, almost a physical comedian. He walks funny. He runs funny. The way he puts on his hat is just so weaselly, you know, it's not just the way he talks. He doesn't have a word in this minute, but, from 50 feet away, you can tell that this guy is a weaselly villain.
Yeah, he's such a toady, and it sets him up for stuff in the future too. I mean, you like you said, it's all physical. He just kind of broadcasts like, don't trust this guy, and he's looking out for number one. He pretends like the thing that matters to him is Red Skull, but no, he's Zola's the top guy on his list of people to take care of.
Well, go ahead.
I'll just say, if a comedian is someone who makes you laugh, I'm not sure what you call someone whose role is to perform and make you feel kind of anxious, to sort of give you anxiety, but he's the physical that, you know, he's running, he's scrambling. Like I said, nothing's quite fitting right. He's in a hurry. He's skittering out of there. And
he's a great Grima of worm tongue, kind of a fellow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, skittering is a great word.
Yeah.
But you watch him in something like The Detectorist, and he's just this calming, very sort of mellow, laid back influence. Obviously, the same physical type, but so very, very different. Although even still, when he gets uptight in that show, you get some of that same feeling.
Yeah, he's really embodying this character, and it struck me that he's almost performing like a silent film star, because again, he has no dialogue, but you can tell from a distance who he is and what kind of character he is, and It's really beautifully done. It's almost Chaplin-esque, you know, his performance in this minute of the film.
Yeah, and definitely not like he knows he can't defeat Captain America physically, so he has to figure out he's like Red Skull without muscles. He has to figure out, how fast can I get out of here, And what do I need to bring with me that I can trade in the future? Because I'm thinking Zola probably has an escape plan from Red Skull. I'm thinking he's thinking someday there'll be an Operation Paperclip for him. And the only thing he has to trade is his brains. And so hanging on to what he's already created is his only coin.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it strikes me as you say that, you know, I've had the misfortune of being laid off of jobs before. And when they give you the box and you're looking at your desk, what do you grab? You grab the stuff that's going to be useful for your next job, you know, aside from the pictures of your kids and, you know, the personal stuff. You grab examples of the work you've done. You grab examples of, you know, not trade secrets or anything, because that would be unethical, but stuff that'll be helpful to you in the future. And I think he's doing exactly the same thing in this. He knows he's going to have to set up shop somewhere else for someone, maybe someone else, you know, maybe the other side. And like you say, he's stuffing that valise with his meal ticket.
Yeah. He's got that early edition of What Color Is Your Parachute? So yes. Ready to roll.
Right. Along with the original German text of Who Moved My Cheese?
Yes. All the other things that you get free from your overlords when it's time for a layoff. Right. Oh, thank you for an idea.
And then dear. They disintegrate you.
Yes. Yes. Oh, no, absolutely. Not again. Yeah. So don't be the bowl of petunias. Wow. Well, this has been an intriguing. We did actually talk about the minute. What a refreshing change. But we've got more minutes to come. Now 64 minutes in. But join us for minute 65. We do enjoy hearing from you too. We've been getting a bunch of different emails from people, and it's, you know, we really enjoy hearing from everybody about what they're thinking about the show, and helps us make a better show. So if you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests when we have them. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.